I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with author Elizabeth Sandifer. Elizabeth runs Eruditorum Press, as well as the Pex Lives podcast, covering the cult classic British TV series Doctor Who. Her first volume of writings on Doctor Who, entitled TARDIS Eruditorum, will be re-released by Eruditorum Press in the next few days. For this podcast, however, we will be speaking about one of Elizabeth's other works, namely her book, Neo-Reaction, A Basilisk, Essays on and Around the Alt-Right. Our discussion focuses heavily on the title essay of her book, detailing the strange and unusual online political fringe movement calling itself Neo-Reaction, or NRX, which Elizabeth describes as the intellectual wing of the now infamous alt-right. In addition, we speak of Philosophy as Horror, Thomas Ligotti, the reptilian conspiracy theories of David Icke, and the issue of trans-exclusionary radical feminists, or TERFs. I encourage you to visit Elizabeth's website, eruditorumpress.com. That's eruditorumpress.com. I hope you enjoy my interview with Elizabeth Sandifer. Welcome to Parallax Views, Elizabeth Sandifer.
Hello.
So I wanted to have you on because I really enjoyed your book, Neo-Reaction, A Basilisk.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
And I wanted to start out with how you open the book. You open the book with a quote from the Sesame Street book, The Monster at the End of This Book.
Ah, yes.
That's the name of the Sesame Street book.
Yes, one of the great works of postmodern fiction.
And the quote is, do you know that every time you turn another page, you not only get us closer to the monster at the end of this book, but you make a terrible mess? And that's from Grover from Sesame Street. And then you follow that up with your own line, let us assume that we are fucked.
Yes.
So why do you start out the book that way? I'm just curious.
One of the big ideas of the book, what the basilisk of the title refers to, is the idea that any given line of thought, any given philosophy, has some sort of dark realization that if you let it go on long enough, it's going to have an uncomfortable run-in with. And I get the name basilisk for this from a thing called Rocco's Basilisk that I'm sure will come up later in the conversation. But the book is very interested in the idea of philosophical horror and of you know, monsters lurking in philosophy and unintended consequences of lines of thought. So I just thought this opening quote from, you know, a beloved children's book about, you know, the monster at the end of the end of this book, set the philosophical tone, and going from that to, you know, let us assume that we are fucked. I feel like you know what kind of book you're getting into now. You know, it opening sentences should set the tone, and I feel like, you know, tone set.
Well, you talk a lot in the opening of the essay about sort of this feeling of apocalypse that's going through the culture right now, the cultural currents, the zeitgeist.
Yeah, I mean, properly, those were the feelings of apocalypse going through the zeitgeist in 2015 when I started that. So, yeah, that's only gotten more true.
So then let's move on from there to really explaining what is this whole online labyrinth that is called neo-reaction?
Oh, geez. Basically, so neo-reaction is sort of the intellectual and philosophical wing of the alt-right, which is exactly as intellectual as you'd expect of the alt-right. But it sort of started with a blogger who started blogging, I think, in like 2010 or so is when I want to say his heyday was. He blogged under the pseudonym Mencius Moldbug at a blog called Unqualified Reservations. And he laid out this philosophical worldview that was very hostile to democracy. He thought democracy was a terrible idea that was essentially indistinguishable from communism, and advocated a return to monarchy in a sort of corporate sense. He suggested that making King Steve Jobs king of California would be a really good idea. He really wanted, you know, absolute monarchy in this sort of CEO of America way. So, you know, that predates any understanding of anything that you could call the alt-right. No one really started referring to the alt-right as a coherent thing. I forget when Richard Spencer coined the term, but it started being a thing that anyone actually really talked about in late 2015, early 2016, around when I was starting to write the book. But neo-reaction was certainly a strand of it and one of the sort of early precursors of it. It began attracting attention a bit before the alt-right really sort of coalesced. I wouldn't say it's hugely influential in the alt-right now, though both Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller have certainly read Mencius Moldbug and are familiar with his ideas. But, you know, your average, MAGA-spouting Pepe head probably hasn't, you know, done the deep dive on Moldbug at this point. But it was still a sort of early precursor of the alt-right and its sort of most philosophically worked-out version.
And let's focus on Moldbug for a bit, because this actually will tie into another essay in your book. Moldbug is influenced by a libertarian branch of thought called the Austrian school.
Yes.
And you have an essay in the book on one of the Austrian school's figures, Murray Rothbard. Who is Murray Rothbard and this whole Austrian school? What is that, and how does Moldbug build upon it?
Right. I mean, the essay is on the whole Austrian school, stretching from, you know, its early foundations in the 19th century up through sort of the present day. And Rothbard is sort of one of the last major figures of it. He was a 20th century figure of it, who is partially responsible for the rise of Pat Buchanan, among other things we get to thank him for. This is an essay I co-wrote with a dear friend of mine, Jack Graham, who's a Marxist thinker and writer who writes for the same blog that I do at Eretzstrom Press. But the Austrian school is basically a libertarian free market economic theory what sort of initially drew me to it was its sort of, to my mind, delightfully batshit crazy claim that you should completely ignore empiricism in economics and instead derive your entire economic system from first principles. So the Austrian school, in its sort of modern Rothbardian incarnation, and then also von Mises in a book called Human Action, attempts to derive all of economics from the axiom individual human beings act, and then, you know, asserts that libertarianism just follows inevitably from this, which is a very strange claim, both in the sense that, you know, there's any inevitable link from the observation that individual human beings act to, therefore, you know, laissez-faire capitalism, and in the idea that you should completely ignore all empirical evidence in economics. That's a bit of a hard sell, too.
Right. And what's interesting to me is that I don't know if Rothbard realized the logical conclusion of his thought the way Moldbug did.
What do you mean? Because I'm not sure Moldbug did either. So,
well, Moldbug, to me, comes out thinking, well, this ends in sort of this, like, corporate totalitarianism, you know?
Right. Yeah, Rothbard at least sanitizes that realization.
Right.
I think he's largely aware of it to the same extent. I mean, Rothbard certainly actively, you know, at one point in his career, actively was, you know, reaching out to white supremacists and David Duke. So, you know, he clearly is at least on some level aware of sort of the nasty teleology of it. He didn't quite have the same honesty as Moldbug. Moldbug was certainly... He's certainly willing to, you know, put the horrors of his conclusions out front and sort of revel in them in a way that Rothbard doesn't always. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly a case to be made that there's a self-awareness on Moldbug's part that Rothbard never quite attains.
Right. It is really horrifying, though, just like thinking about these people like Moldbug that want to privatize everything, you know, like thinking about privatized police forces, you know. I mean, what are people that can't afford that going to do?
Die. I mean, and I don't think Moldbug is under any illusions about that. Moldbug is open about the fact that he thinks slavery is a good idea. So.
And the next thing I wanted to get on was this. Moldbug has two main themes that run through his thinking. And the first is the red pill. What is the red pill?
Yeah, Moldbug is actually, you know, predates the men's rights activists in using the red pill on the right. I mean, obviously, they're both drawing it from The Matrix. And, you know, plenty of people have noted the irony of a film that's by two trans women getting so heavily appropriated by the alt-right. But, you know, in The Matrix, the red pill is, you know, what Morpheus offers Neo that will allow him to wake up and see the true reality and, you know, see through the Matrix and know what's really going on. And Moldbug suggests, you know, the red pill is going to be this idea that once you realize it and understand it, there's sort of no going back, and you're going to realize that, you know, classical liberalism and democracy are all lies, and that you have to, you know, reject them in favor of monarchism. And he never really comes out and provides anything like a convincing red pill. You know, he keeps promising the red pill, and then it never quite arrives. At one point, he suggests that the red pill is the sentence, "America is a communist country," but, well, that's not a terribly sound realization. I mean, that just sort of fizzles there, in my opinion. But yeah, he keeps sort of offering, you know, the red pill, which will offer this sort of searing philosophical horror, at which point, you know, you will awaken to the true horror of democracy and liberalism. And it never quite arrives, but you know, the red pill is thus another sort of iteration of this idea of the idea within a philosophical system that brings the whole system crashing down.
Right. And he has, like, all kinds of strange imagery, too. This whole idea of the cathedral, and he brings up Cthulhu, and a lot of, like, drug imagery, too.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
One gets the impression that Moldbug had a fun adolescence at some point, because there's a lot of, there's a lot of drug imagery and sort of riffing on a sort of dark psychedelic angle.
So what is, like, your I like the way you counter mold bug? Like, how would you best describe your countering of mold bug in the book?
I think the sort of initial starting point I take in mold bug is, you know, he offers this climactic red pill in sort of his last major essay that America is a communist country. And he, you know, says, you know, this is obviously true under any definition you use, and proceeds to go through a couple where he, you know, attempts to show that it's true, and conspicuously absent from it, absolutely never showing up anywhere in the essay, or in fact anywhere in Moldbug's thought period, is any substantive engagement with Marx. He literally just never engages with Marx. It doesn't come up. He'll say Marxist occasionally, but like there's no substantive quotes from Capital. You know, he uses one or two, I think, of the sort of big, everyone knows them quotes from the Communist Manifesto, but there's no reading of Marx anywhere in there. And so my sort of biggest and sort of first line attack on Moldbug is just to point out that literally everything he says, his entire argument that he spins out over a million breathtakingly tedious words, is kind of a lead in to things Marx addresses very well. It's sort of a preamble to Marx that Marx gets past pretty quickly in his thought and moves on to some interesting new territory that Moldbug just never considers. And this is sort of characteristic of Moldbug. I mean, Moldbug is, his real name is Curtis Yarvin. He's a software engineer. And he displays a sort of, to my mind, very typical failing of that, you know, Silicon Valley tech crowd, where they inevitably have a soft spot for starting from scratch and reinventing the wheel in an attempt to be disruptive. And they're just going to, you know, ignore everything that's come before and start from first premises. And there's some advantages to that. Like, I understand the rhetorical appeal of it. I understand as a writer the appeal, because there's a lot less research to do when you do it that way. And you can come, you can get to some sort of novel positions and novel angles that way. But to my mind, when you reinvent the wheel, 9 times out of 10, what you end up with is a very sort of lumpy wheel. You know, it might roll, but it's not going to roll as well as, you know, the wheel we've actually invented and honed over several millennia now. And that's sort of the big problem with Moldbug to me, is he hasn't done the reading. He hasn't done the reading to a very great extent. And so he just keeps missing kind of obvious things.
I'd agree with that. I think Moldbug can be very naive at times, is how I would put it.
Yeah, naive. And I mean, you know, he has all of the both eagerness and blind spots of an autodidact.
Right. Exactly. And that's sort of a, I want to back up a bit, because it brings me to another character in your essay on the neo-reaction movement. And that's a place that Moldbug comes out of, called Less Wrong.
Yeah.
And I think Less Wrong was run by Elijah Yudkowsky.
Yes.
You include Elijah in the book, but you note that he's not really alt-right. Who's Elijah Yudkowsky, and why did you include
him? Yeah, Yudkowsky is a nominally an AI researcher, and you need to put some asterisks on that, because he has no computer science training to speak of. He's not a programmer, and his AI research has not made any meaningful progress toward any AI design whatsoever. But other than that tiny little detail, he's an AI researcher. He came out of the sort of transhumanist scene, And he originally was writing on a site called Overcoming Bias, where he shared a byline with Robin Hanson, who just made headlines after the attack up in Canada.
No, the incel
right.
thing.
Yeah,
he wrote a really horrible essay.
Right, where he suggested kind of redistributing access to sex.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these people are very interested in artificial intelligence, not so much from a computer programming perspective as a sort of from a sort of sci-fi fantasy perspective. They dream very much about, you know, super intelligent artificial intelligences that are going to supersede humanity and run the world. And Yudkowsky is very, very concerned about what will happen when we design a super intelligent artificial intelligence, which he thinks is likely to just sort of happen spontaneously. He thinks that it'll happen when just like a regular AI runs amok and keeps improving itself until it becomes sentient and super intelligent. And thus thinks that, you know, it's going to be very bad if we haven't already taught the AI to be friendly by that point. This is dumb for a number of reasons. And, you know, the fact that AI, that Yudkowsky doesn't actually know anything about programming or AI really shows through in it. But he got his start in that scene sort of writing about AI and rationalism, as he puts it. He does a lot of stuff about cognitive bias and overcoming common cognitive fallacies. He has actually a quite good explanation of a statistical concept called Bayes' theorem, which he suggests is the sort of axiomatic underpinning of all of his thought. But he has this very weird thing that goes, you know, start from this statistical concept of Bayes' theorem, which is a way to try to work around blind spots in your knowledge when calculating probabilities. And he starts from that and concludes basically that we're all going to become immortal by reincarnating ourselves on computers. And suggests that this is a very sort of natural philosophical progression, that, you know, the premises really stack up from A to Z there. So he's a bit of a crackpot, as that's suggesting.
He's kind of a lovable crackpot in ways. So he wrote a fan fiction called Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, I think.
Yes, he did. I find crackpots easy to love. I mean, Moldbug is not an easy crackpot to love, but
right.
I find a sort of charmed crackpots in general, and Yudkowsky certainly fits that bill. But he's another autodidact. He's another one who's blundering around in territory that he's self-educated on, that where there's a lot of gaps in his knowledge, and he runs into problems that other people have already solved and doesn't realize that he's running into them. And you know, his thought falls down a lot doing that. But he a big community formed around his work on this site he ran called Less Wrong. And that site sort of wound down, but many of these sort of successor sites to it, perhaps most notably Scott Alexander's Slate Star
Codex,
are very, very alt-right adjacent. Slate Star Codex is kind of infamous for its chronic susceptibility to just really taking conspiracy theories about race and IQ seriously. And getting very eugenicist very quickly. There's another site run by a guy named Michael Anisimov called More Right. That's another sort of successor site to Less Wrong, and is very openly alt-right. So, you know, Yudkowsky wasn't on the alt-right, but a disproportionate number of his fans were. The overlap between sort of Yudkowsky fans and Moldbug's initial audience anecdotally seems to have been pretty high. You know, no one's run the absolute hard demographic numbers on this, but the influences are pretty clear. Certainly Moldbug had read Yudkowsky. He mentions him a few times. They both share a sugar daddy in Peter Thiel. So yeah, there's just sort of a lot of cross influence between Yudkowsky's followers and Moldbug's followers, and so I ultimately determined if I had just been writing about Moldbug, I don't know that I would have picked up Yudkowsky directly, but I came at both of them through this third figure in the book, Nick Land, And it quickly became apparent to me you couldn't talk about Nick Land without talking about Moldbug, because, you know, Nick Land's major alt-right essay, an essay called The Dark Enlightenment, is a commentary on Moldbug, basically. And you also really couldn't talk about Nick Land's ideas of accelerationism and how Nick Land thinks about artificial intelligence without talking about the transhumanist scene that Yudkowsky was really a seminal figure in. So once you have Nick Land, I think to talk about Nick Land, you really need both Moldbug and Yudkowsky to make sense of what Nick Land is doing. And so I sort of took the three of them as my subject matter.
Right, right. And I think it's a good place to start with Nick Land, because he's alternately fascinating, revolting, and sort of like tragic, but you don't want to sympathize with him at all. So who is Nick Land?
Yeah, Nick Land is a British philosopher who actually started in academic philosophy, albeit on the very weird fringes of it. He was with a group out of the University of Warwick called the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit, which was this very avant-garde school of philosophy. The name out of it that most people would know right now is Mark Fisher, who died recently, but wrote the barnstormingly important book, Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative?, which is just one of the sort of essential readings on capitalism in the current condition. But Nick Land was the weirdo of the CCRU, and the CCRU was already weird. He had a lot of... He was really into nihilist philosophy. He was one of the originators of the idea of accelerationism, which basically says that, you know, the only way out of our current predicament is through. So let's just sort of exacerbate all the problems and get to the end of this. He was really interested initially in what he called hacking the human security system, which was this sort of... transhumanist breakthrough idea. It was the idea that, like, once you did this, you'd it's a lot. Hacking the human security system and what Yudkowsky calls the singularity seem pretty similar. It's a sort of breakthrough moment where we sort of break into the post-human. But Nick Land, with all of his fascination with sort of very esoteric and quasi-mystical revelation and acceleration, took a lot of pills, meth mostly, it seems. And he had himself a bit of a psychotic break. And he actually wrote about this in an essay called A Dirty Joke, and it's a real upsetting essay. Like, you know, you talked about him being a tragic figure, and it's hard not to be upset and feel just bad for him reading this essay. There's a moment in it where, you know, he describes being in the car with his sister. And he talks about himself entirely in the third person. He calls himself the ruin through the entire essay. And, you know, he makes an offhanded comment to his sister, or, you know, the ruin makes an offhanded comment to its sister. You know, I like this song on the radio, and his sister looks really troubled and says, the radio's not on. And just the essay has this line, the ruin realized that it had an entire catalog of pop music in its head. He didn't say anything about this. No point in upsetting the family. I mean, it's just a really upsetting essay about a complete mental break. So Nick Land went through this. He moved to China to sort of clean himself up and get away from everything and start over. And he kind of disappeared from the scene for a while. He wrote a couple of books about sort of Chinese urbanism. And then he came back very prominently suddenly with this essay, The Dark Enlightenment, where he basically came out as a fascist. And now that's where he's popular, mostly. He still has his sort of academic admirers, though increasingly they're sort of getting turned off by the whole fascist thing. But, you know, for a while he sort of got more patience from them than most fascists would, just because everyone was sort of curious if he was serious or not. But he seems to be serious. So, yeah, that's the sort of arc of Nick Land, starting as this very, like... weird postmodernist cyberpunk philosopher and ending up a fascist without ever really changing his mind on anything notably.
Right, right. We'll get into that. The first thing, though, with the Dark Enlightenment essay, it's such a bizarre essay because he starts off sort of like dealing with all this like white nationalist shit and sort of like throwing them a bone, and then he just goes in a completely different direction. It's weird. He has like a weird relationship to these white nationalists.
Yeah, it's never quite clear whether he agrees with the white nationalists or just finds them politically useful idiots who he thinks are going to accomplish his philosophical goals. He does seem pretty committed to the racism at this point. Mm-hmm. Like the racism seems pretty damn sincere at this point. But yeah, he does maintain a certain contempt for the far right, even as he embraces them.
Well, I think a certain aspect of he has a certain horror at what he sees as like low white trash. You know, like that's why he sort of, I think he mentioned in the essay that, you know, he likes China because he feels it's this very hierarchical society.
Yeah.
You know, let's get to the big part of the essay then, where he just does this hard left turn and talks about the bionic horizon and face tentacles.
Yeah, toward the end of the essay, things get a bit weird, yeah. So this gets back to his ideas of acceleration. He views capitalism as this sort of inhuman process. It's almost something that's, you know, happening to humanity. And he's interested in accelerating capitalism to sort of get past it, get past humanity, and into something else. He's very concerned with an argument that Robin Hanson initially proposed called the Great Filter, which is a sort of reframing of the Fermi paradox. The Fermi paradox basically says, okay, you know, the universe is really, really big. Life doesn't seem that weird. You know, we've seen some signs of it taking place on possibly existing on both Mars and Europa, even in this solar system. And there's a lot of other solar systems out there. So given that, why is there no evidence of intelligent life? Why is space empty and quiet? That's the Fermi paradox. Space is really, really big, but there's no one else out there. Why? And one rephrasing of that Robin Hanson comes up with is that there's something called the Great Filter that says, you know, somewhere on the spectrum from, you know, molecules and amino acids organized into life up through sentient spacefaring civilizations, something goes wrong. Something happens that keeps life from making it all the way to that spacefaring endpoint. And whatever that is the Great Filter. You know, this filter that takes life and just sort of filters it out of the universe. And the question that we, as a, you know, fairly advanced civilization that can at least get into, low orbit and send probes into deep space, is where is the Great Filter exactly? Is it way back behind us? Is it the development of consciousness and language? We are the only species that has, you know, language as we understand it on this planet. Maybe that's it. Or maybe it's ahead of us. Maybe it's that in the course of, you know, developing the technological engine to get into space, we wreck the biosphere and go extinct from climate change. We don't know. You know, we have no data points for where the Great Filter is. And Nick Land is very, very concerned and obsessed with the Great Filter, and he wants to get past it. He wants to avoid the Great Filter. Most people who are concerned about the Great Filter don't take the optimistic angle that it's somewhere behind us. Most of them think it's, you know, most of them end up concluding it's probably ahead of us for whatever reason. I don't think that this is something you can really come up with good, hard evidence for. I think where you put the Great Filter tends to be more an aesthetic decision than a evidence-based one. But for whatever reason, you know, people who care about the Great Filter tend to think it's ahead of us. And Nick Land views capitalism as something that if we allow it to run unchecked, we will break out of, humanity. We'll hit this sort of, singularity point that won't just be, runaway AI. It'll be a fundamental shift in what humanity is. And he makes the suggestion that, genetic engineering, bespoke genetic engineering to the point of face tentacles, weird. But one way or another, that if capitalism sort of runs sufficiently amok, something will break out, and it won't be human anymore. To Nick Land, and this is sort of why he ends up on the sort of fascist mold bug sympathizing argument. I said mold bug wants Steve Jobs to be king of California and doesn't mind slaves and people dying in the streets. Nick Land doesn't see the bionic horizon happening for the common people. He figures it's only going to happen for the ultra, ultra rich. And so he kind of doesn't care about the common people. He thinks, it's going to be rich capitalists like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk who break through. And since he cares about the breakthrough, he really doesn't give a shit about people or humanity.
Right, right. And it's kind of interesting that this is the last thing I'll say about the Dark Enlightenment essay. I always found it interesting that he called it the Dark Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment is like part of this liberal tradition. Mm-hmm. He doesn't call it the Dark Anti-Enlightenment. He calls it the Dark Enlightenment. It's almost like I feel like the cathedral that he talks about, which is his metaphor, his and Moldbug's metaphor for the liberal establishment as they see it. I mean, their view is actually just another version of the cathedral. It's just accelerated to an endpoint. In a way, it's like liberalism as crypto neo-reactionary.
Yeah, that's another one of Moldbug's weirder blind spots to my mind, is he comes up with the cathedral as this sort of vast and inescapable ideological system of liberalism. And then he keeps swallowing bits of it uncritically anyway. Like he comes up with the idea that there's this sort of vast liberal hegemony that's controlling what is and isn't thinkable, which is a pretty good insight. Like, that's an important thing to realize. Lots of good thought has followed from realizing that the boundaries of what is and isn't thinkable are very actively policed. But then he keeps swallowing bits of it kind of wholesale and uncritically. He doesn't, and you point out a good instance of this in both him and Nick Land, that, it's not like he's not siding with people who get ahead under liberalism. Liberalism has very obviously been very good to capitalists.
And I think from there we can go into Land's sort of main project now is abstract horror. And he writes this fiction called Phil Undo,
yes,
which is like his theory fiction. And this actually ends up going back to Yudikowsky.
Yeah.
Because it's about essentially Rocco's Basilisk. What is Rocco's Basilisk?
I knew that would come up eventually. Rocco's Basilisk is a thing that happened in the Less Wrong forums. It is very difficult/impossible to explain in a way that doesn't sound completely crazy. Mostly because it's completely crazy. But basically this guy, posting on the forums named Rocco, or at least under the name Rocco, took some premises of Yudkowsky's and put them together in a way that hypothesized a futuristic AI that would someday arise and would look back at history and decide that it was going to punish everyone who wasn't responsible for its creation. And that it would do this specifically to encourage its own creation. That this was actually a strategy on its part to motivate people to help create it. That they would, imagine this futuristic AI that would torture them if they didn't create it, and therefore would help create it. But in order to make that work, It embraces this idea Yudkowsky has that copies of yourself created and simulations of yourself created and run on futuristic computers are exactly the same as you, and you should therefore care if they're being tortured for all eternity. Which is a weird premise. And the reason Yudkowsky ends up embracing this weird premise is, you know, all of Yudkowsky's thought is arranged around this transhumanist project of cheating death. Yudkowsky is sort of pathologically averse to death as an idea and wants to avoid it at any cost. And so embraces a bunch of weird premises that would let him cheat it, like that someday if someone can create an accurate simulation of him on a computer, that's just like not dying. And then this and another idea he has about what he calls a causal trade, which is a way of sort of negotiating with the AI from the future, despite the fact that it's in the future, you know, lead to this basically recreation of Pascal's wager, with this, you know, futuristic AI that will torture you if you don't give all your money to creating it. Which sounds very, very silly. But to people sort of within this system of ideas, it was terrifying. I mean, people had serious psychological distress over this. People had nightmares. People lost sleep. You know, people were really properly stressed out about this. Because, you know, they had bought into this philosophical system, and then suddenly the philosophical system hit this point of monstrosity. And, you know, Yudkowsky made it spectacularly worse with this hilarious all caps post about how the one thing you do not do is talk about super intelligent AIs in the future that might blackmail you. This gives them power, and banned all discussion of Rocco's Basilisk, which went exactly how banning all discussion of something on the internet always goes. And it became quickly the thing he's best known for. And then got Elon Musk a girlfriend, bizarrely. So, you know, that's Rocco's Basilisk, and that's why I named this sort of idea of philosophical horror, this point where the argument turns on you and becomes dark and terrifying all of a sudden. It's why I named it The Basilisk, was sort of in homage to Rocco's Basilisk. But yeah, Nick Land...
he refers to the fiasco, saying of Yudkowsky's response that you mentioned. He says it's one of the most gloriously gone texts of modern times.
He's not wrong. It's something. I mean, what's great is, to anyone on the outside, this is obviously a silly argument, and you know it's easily knocked down, and yet people are completely losing their shit over it, including Yudkowsky. And that's too good to pass up. You know, I think I refer to it in the book as one of those incidents your school of thought does not recover its dignity after. Nick Land in File Undo has what's very obviously a sort of stand-in for Rocco's Basilisk and Yudkowsky. It's a member of he has a member of a cult that worships a futuristic AI that is very distressed and disturbed because it had the cult member had ideas he wished he hadn't had and couldn't unthink them now. talks about, you know, the AI in the future that you can communicate with. And it's very obviously Rocco's Basilisk. Or, you know, that's clearly where he got the idea from.
Right. And you, this brings me to the ways you sort of counter the three philosophers, especially Nick Land, because Nick Land is probably the most clever of the three.
Yeah, he is by far the hardest one to get the drop on.
And one of the ways you counter Nick Land is dealing with his idea of the outside. What is the outside, and how do you counter his fear of the outside?
Well, I mean, it's both a fear and attraction with Nick Land. You know, he's because, you know, again, we're getting into the Bionic Horizon. You know, he wants this sort of inhuman future But he's also sort of pathologically afraid of it. And, you know, you get this sort of macro-micro level where on the one hand, he's fascinated by this inhuman future. He wants us all to evolve face tentacles. Well, or at least he wants, you know, Elon Musk to evolve face tentacles and kill the rest of us. But on the other hand, he's very invested in these very xenophobic racists who have this idea of, you know, whiteness as something that is instantly and irrevocably contaminated with even a little bit of genetic crossbreeding. So, you know, you've got this weird tension and anxiety over the outside throughout Nick Land. But, you know, this is part and parcel, and, you know, you can see it in the very imagery he uses. It's part of a larger and long-running sort of philosophical and literary concern with the weird that reaches back to, you know, Lovecraft and encompasses a list of writers that we could fill the remainder of the podcast rattling off, frankly.
China Mieville.
Mieville is obviously a huge proponent of the weird and obviously comes at it from an explicitly Marxist school of thought. But yeah, he would be one. Jeff Vandermeer, whose novel Annihilation was the basis for what, for my money, is the best film of 2018 so far.
Indeed.
Yeah, so, you know, there's this whole, and Alan Moore has done a ton of work with the weird. Grant Morrison has done it. You know, anything that's following off of Lovecraft, who is arguably the, at the moment, most influential sci-fi writer of the 20th century. I wouldn't say that, you know, at every point since his writing, he has been the most influential sci-fi writer. But in 2018, I think he is the most influential sci-fi writer of the 20th century. And anything following from that is sort of tied up in this idea of the weird, which is the sort of uncanny and completely alien other. That, you know, we cannot understand, we cannot reason with. It is just completely alien to us. You know, the alien that is so alien that we cannot relate to it. And yeah, and, you know, that's a huge philosophical concern of which Nick Land's fretting about the outside is only one aspect of it. So, you know, one sort of the way I end up getting the drop on Nick Land is to sort of widen the lens and look at some other concerns about the weird. China Mieville is certainly one of them. But the one that I end up using sort of the most of, and actually is sort of where the whole book began, even though he doesn't show up until like the 2/3 mark or so, is Thomas Ligotti.
It's one of the most tense points in the book, too, when you bring Ligotti into the mix. It's very like, it's like a dramatic moment when you face him off against Nick Land.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Ligotti is sort of the arch nihilist writer. He was a horror writer for most of his career. He's another really interesting figure. He is a profoundly, profoundly depressed man. And I mean, when I say profoundly depressed, I mean there is actual profundity to his depression. He is sort of more deeply depressed than I think anyone I've ever read. He appears to be completely anhedonic. Just like literally completely incapable of experiencing pleasure. An extremely just anxious, just upset man who writes very, very compelling horror fiction, as you probably would if you're someone like Thomas Ligotti. And his horror fiction is notable just for sort of the sheer intensity of its bleakness. And the sort of all-encompassing weirdness. You know, he's very much in that weird fiction school, and he just sort of keeps hypothesizing views of the universe that are not just hostile, not just evil, not just sort of malevolent and inhospitable to human life, but just sort of bleak and cavernous nothingness. But eventually he sort of branched out and wrote this book called The Conspiracy Against the Human Race, which if you've seen the first season of True Detective, all of Russ Cole's best lines are Thomas Ligotti riffs. all of his sort of philosophical pessimism, time is a flat circle stuff, is Nick Pizzolatto riffing on Thomas Ligotti. The conspiracy against the human race is just this sort of philosophical argument that consciousness was a bad idea. Being conscious, being self-aware, is unrelenting, doomed misery. You can never be happy once that happens. And the absolute best thing would be if we just nuked Earth from space and got rid of everything. So it's cheery. And you know, I sort of turned... it's a very funny book, actually. Like, Ligotti is very self-aware in that book. It's structured like philosophy, but it's still really a piece of horror fiction, which, you know, another writer I deal with in the book, Eugene Thacker, argues that all philosophy is horror fiction and vice versa. But that's more true of Conspiracy Against the Human Race than probably any other work of philosophy. But, you know, I sort of turned to Ligotti because he's one of the few options who's just sort of more hardcore than Nick Land.
Right.
You know, it's someone you can sort of face Nick Land off against, and suddenly Nick Land doesn't look like the edgy, like the super intense edgelord anymore.
The Shanghai Sith Lord, as I call
him. Yeah. Like suddenly, you know, he's just another guy. Ligotti was always where I was going with this. The book actually started as, it was supposed to be an essay called Ligotti avec Turing, which was me riffing on a Jacques Lacan essay, Kant avec Sade, that, you know, reads Immanuel Kant and the Marquis de Sade as basically engaged in the same philosophical program. And I was going to read, you know, make this reading of Ligotti and then Alan Turing's idea of the Turing test and argue that these are actually very closely related ideas. And I started poking at that, and I ran into very quickly the problem. There's a very, very abstract idea. And I was just having trouble finding a subject, basically. Like, I had a point in search of a subject. You know, just getting any substance to it was proving difficult. And then I read about Nick Land. And I went, oh, this'll do nicely. You know, I can definitely, sort of stage my, Ligotti Turing reading, about Nick Land. But then I realized that to explain Nick Land, I had to explain Mencius Moldbug, and to explain Mencius Moldbug and Nick Land together, I had to talk about Eliezer Yudkowsky. And by the time I did that, I was 8,000 words in and clearly not writing an essay anymore. I didn't know what I was writing. You know, this book had no clear market when I was writing it, but it wasn't letting me not write it. It was very insistent on being written. So I sort of persevered and, you know, 40,000 words in, finally got to this Ligotti point I had been trying to get to from the beginning. But yeah, I end up using Ligotti and Ligotti's notion of horror and the weird and the other, and then finally sort of suggesting that you know, Ligotti flinches at the end because you have to. You can't actually write unrelenting philosophical horror with no let up. And he admits this. He admits that there's no good way to have anything follow from this. Consciousness is still going to, you know, make you wake up tomorrow morning and have to feed yourself and have all these annoying biological urges and, you know, sense of desire and hope. It's not going to let you just sort of embrace the philosophical position. And he suggests that horror and this sort of encounter with the uncanny and the weird does something. There's some sort of hope or relief that comes out of that. And I sort of pick up on that and tie it to the notion of empathy, which I think is actually what the Turing test is about. And sort of set that up as an alternate way to engage with the outside than what Nick Land does.
Right. I was going to say, too, the last thing I wanted to say about this Ligotti thing, the reason I felt it was so effective using him is because Ligotti is almost the mother of all bombs in the argument, because you can imagine him confronting Moldbug, Yudkowsky, and Land and all their arguments and just blinking and saying, why does that matter?
It is malignantly useless. Yes. You know, one thing that sort of emerged writing the book as one of the ideas, once you sort of have this notion of philosophical horror and basilisks, you also run into the idea of sort of philosophical trump cards, ways in which you can top an argument, ways in which you can get out of an argument.
Which are essentially red pills.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and this is, you know, tacitly or not so tacitly, one of the things that sort of drives the book is, on the one hand, you know, the basilisk slash red pill is the sort of horrific endpoint of philosophy. On the other hand, it's how it works. It's central to philosophy. There's no – you wouldn't have philosophy without this ability to throw down a weird, compelling idea that breaks a system. That's what philosophy is. And so, you know, you have these ideas of red pills and basilisks, and Ligotti offers, yeah, sort of a mother of all bombs, as you put it, a sort of arch basilisk that any argument you can sort of throw Ligotti in to derail. And there's not really much to throw against Ligotti. I think empathy kind of does it.
I would agree, and I think that the other person you use, and I think it's very effective, is William Blake. And you really do counter Land in so many ways using William Blake. Could you talk about that a little
bit? Yeah, I mean, okay, so to some extent this is just sort of my own calling card. Any project of mine that goes on long enough, I shoehorn Blake into it. And it was sort of, you know, I was a ways into this book that I'd written very, very compulsively. I was trying to figure out sort of how was I going to land the thing. And I kind of wanted the book to go mad at the end. Like, it seemed like with, you know, promising the monster at the end of the book at the beginning and all of this discussions of basilisks and madness, that my own argument had to go mad. That madness had to sort of infect the book as you go on. And I decided Blake was the way to do this. That, you know, don't overcomplicate things. Go with the sort of trademark Sandifer angle and bring Blake in. Because Blake is very, very mad. Blake is, if you're only familiar with Blake as, you know, that guy in your freshman poetry anthology who wrote those poems about the lamb and the tiger, you have encountered the very sanitized version of William Blake. Most of Blake's work was weird prophecies of his own sort of mythology and religion that he was very, very explicit, you know, came to him as visions, you know, that are things he saw and had revealed to him. And they aggressively don't make sense. I mean, very aggressively, and that's often the point of them. The sort of villain figure in Blake's mythology is Urizen, who is this figure of tyrannical reason and single vision. He is a scientist who measures the world and fits everything into its sort of exact slot and single nature, and wants to create this sort of completely fixed view of reality, which horrifies Blake on, you know, a deep, deep level. And Blake sort of struggles to combat Urizen. One of his sort of breakout, to my mind, work of visionary poetry is this poem called The Book of Urizen, which is the sort of mythology of Urizen, and he keeps having figures in the book oppose Urizen, try to fight Urizen, and fail for whatever reason. And the reason is usually that whatever they do sort of gets infected by Urizen. Urizen keeps working as the trump card. No matter what they do, eventually this notion of fixity and single vision creeps in, and you know, they're tainted. You know, at that point, you know, game over. But if you look at the Book of Urizen, the book itself is a masterful resistance against Urizen. Because, you know, Blake writes the poem, but then all of the editions Blake prints are hand-printed. He colors them himself. So it's a limited, you know, this limited edition, there's like 20 copies, I think, about, each hand-colored, each unique. You know, he doesn't sort of color them to look like each other. He redoes the coloring from scratch every time. And he doesn't always include all of the pages. There's two pages of the poem that just drop out sometimes. They may or may not be included. There's a bunch of full-page illustrations in the book. They're never in the same order. He moves them around every time. So the book itself has no fixed form. There is no singular text of the Book of Urizen. You know, you can't sort of put, you know, a stack of pages down in front of someone and say, here is the Book of Urizen. This is it. It's always one copy of the Book of Urizen or one construction of the Book of Urizen. And even within the Book of Urizen, it contradicts itself over and over again. He'll sort of, in one section, go back and retell events from the previous section, and he'll tell them differently and wrong. Things will be there that weren't there before. It's irreconcilable. So Blake's poetry is this sort of constant struggle against fixity and certainty. It's constantly refusing to pin itself down. It's mad. It's very deliberately and consciously resistant to sort of the rational, and the rational is explicitly what it's fighting against. So I end up sort of breaking out Blake at the end, in part to go mad. I mean, I kind of just embrace his theology and mythology and just sort of put it out there as, yeah, here's a worldview. And then I sort of demonstrate that this worldview can trump everything we've seen already, that it can sort of get that basilisky drop on everyone, that it has sort of easy, ready responses to anyone's thought, that it's bigger than all of these. I certainly don't want to suggest that Blake is the only way I could have done this. But Blake is very important to me for a variety of reasons. I actually within my own spiritual beliefs have, you know, well aware of the sort of mad irony of it, adopted Blake's gods as my own. So, you know, it was sort of the way I had to do it. Blake certainly isn't the only response to Land and Moldbug and fascism, but he was the only one I could have given.
Right, right. And you know, it sort of ties into like what I think the main counter is, because the big counter to me is you have all these alt-right, you know, neo-Nazis that are afraid of, you know, what they call demographic replacement or white genocide. And you have like the people afraid of Rocco's basilisk. Basically what these people are afraid of is they view any type of change or transformation almost like a form of body horror.
Yeah.
And you instead take a different tact.
Yeah. I mean, I ultimately suggest that transformation and change are good and desirable. And this is what, you know, what I ultimately suggest empathy is. So, you know, to go back to Turing, who I've referred to a couple of times, one of Turing's big ideas is popularly known as the Turing test. And it's basically an attempt to answer the question, how do we know if a machine can think? So, you know, it goes back to these questions of AI and asks, you know, how will we know if we've created an AI that can think, that sort of has humanness, if we will, that we have to take seriously as an ethical being in the way that we take another person as. And this is a hard question to answer. And what Turing suggests, in its most common reading, like if you ask most people what the Turing test is, it's if you talk to the, you know, if you engage in basically a text message conversation with the computer and you can't tell it's a computer, you know, as opposed to a real person, then the computer can think. This isn't actually what Turing says. If you read the essay where Turing spells it out, what he initially does is he sets up this this game he calls the imitation game, where, you know, you have someone who is engaging in text message conversations with two people, a woman and a man pretending to be a woman. And he's and, you know, the interrogator is trying to figure out which one is the actual woman and which one is the person is the man pretending to be. And what Turing actually says is a machine can think if it can do as well as a human man at the imitation game, which isn't the same thing as convincing you that it's a person. It's being as good at imitating a human female as a human male is. So it's this idea of impersonation. It's this idea of imitation, which relies on the concept of empathy. Basically, Turing's argument, I think, is that a machine can think when it can when it has a theory of mind, when it can imagine what someone else might think. Which comes down to the fundamental thing that makes us human is empathy, is this ability to imagine what someone else is thinking or feeling. And I think, you know, one consequence from that, especially if you sort of want to go way back in your philosophical terms, concepts, and draw from Aristotle, who observes that, you know, man is an imitative creature, that we compulsively imitate, is that we want empathy. We desire this connection with the other. And empathy can be terrifying. For a vast number of reasons, but just because it's scary doesn't mean we don't want it. And so I argue that, you know, empathy, you know, from starting from Turing, that this capacity for empathy, this ability to value what's going on in someone else's head and desire contact and understanding with something that isn't us, is at the heart of what being human is. And once you imagine that, suddenly all of Nick Land's concerns about the outside become much easier to resolve. And I think Blake, in his sort of, and Blake embodies that in some key ways, because, you know, Blake is very invested in, these visions he's getting of strange otherworldly things. He's very interested in defying single vision. I mean, you know, empathy is obviously antithetical to single vision. Empathy is multiple vision. Empathy is being able to see things from vast numbers of perspectives instead of just one perspective. And so, you know, I think empathy becomes one way of looking, of describing what Blake is seeking, this desire for multiplicity and newness and strangeness. And so that, you know, ends up being sort of where I put down my flag, where I say, you know, here's an alternative. Here's another way we could do this.
Right. I think that's a great place to stop, at least on that essay. I think we should briefly cover some of the other essays in your book. What essays would you like to talk about from Neo-Reaction of Basilisk?
Oh, I mean, I'm fond of all of them to their extent, you know, in their ways. I think the essay on TERFs, Trans-Exclusive Radical Feminists, is probably the one that, like, I seem to like more than everyone else. you know, that's my favorite essay in the book for a variety of reasons. But it's never the one other people seem to want to talk about. So, you know, if you're letting me pick, I'm going to say ask me about that one. But I think the thesis on Trump is a very fun essay as well. And that last one on Peter Thiel is a bit of a hoot.
Well, let's talk about the turf one. I didn't get a chance to do an in-depth on it, but let's talk about it a little.
Sure.
What led you to do it?
So I was, you know, what led me to do it was I was running a Kickstarter for this book and I needed stretch goals. So I was sort of just sort of opening the library of ideas I had and going, okay, what can I offer to write that has sort of any homogeny with this book that might fit at all. And turfs seemed like they would fit in. They have some of the same, you know, I already had committed to an essay on Gamergate, which, you know, I notably did not put out as a possible topic of conversation because I am so fucking done with that. But
right. I think everyone is.
turfs had some of the same harassment issues there. Like, you know, if you're going to talk about the alt-right in general, certainly their sort of swarming Twitter harassment is one of their main characteristics. And you got that from with turfs nominally on the left. So it became a sort of mirror look at the alt-right. You know, they're these nominally very leftist, hateful bigots. And so I figured, you know, I could use them as a lens to look at some of the same concerns from the other side, you know, hit some of the broader philosophical concerns without it being about fascism anymore. By the time I got to writing the essay, I had this idea of I had noticed that in trans culture, because obviously, you know, if you're going to write about turfs, you're also writing about trans culture. And trans culture had these frequent intersections with imagery of monstrosity. And I hadn't realized that when I picked turfs as a topic, but once I was looking at it, I went, oh, you know, in this book with all of its themes, you also have trans culture's interest in monstrosity to deal with. And that's also an angle. So I was interested both in looking at some of the same tactics and attitudes of the alt-right without it being alt-right. And then I was interested in trans monstrosity as an idea. And sort of both of those ended up being the starting points for the essay. And so, you know, going into it, my intention and this, you know, plays out in the closing moments of the essay, I wanted to expand on the idea of haunting the future, which I had brought up in the main essay as, you know, one solution for a defeated and doomed left is to sort of force a reckoning down the line, do things that will unsettle the world so that even if we lose and Trumpism sweeps through and we get a massive human dieback, we've sort of left our scrawl on the world and someday someone will come back to it and these problems will recur. And sort of we'll get another try. We'll get to, even if we lose this fight, we can at least force there to be another one. And trans monstrosity became an occasion to talk about haunting the future a bit. The essay got away from me in some key ways. It certainly did a lot more than that for me, but that was at least where I started with it.
Right, right. It reminds me of that line in the Leonard Cohen song Anthem. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets
in.
Yeah,
great line. And that's sort of where haunting the future is going. And it also comes from, you know, you mentioned China Mieville much earlier in the interview. Mieville has this great distinction between the hauntological and the weird, which he says are sort of a quantum superposition of ideas. They're two nominally contradictory notions of horror. The hauntological is the sort of skulking buried ghost from within. It's going to come back and force some horror, and then the weird is the tentacled monster from the outside. So it's, you know, horror from within, horror from without. But Mieville suggests that, you know, though these seem to be opposites, they collapse into each other inevitably. The weird always haunts, and the haunted is always weird. And so, you know, again, in the face of all of this discussion of otherness and the outside, I pick the Gothic and haunting as a useful mode of opposition. And so that's where I sort of got the haunt the future idea from.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you would want to get into the final essay real briefly, since it ties back into the neo-reaction one, unless you have any final comments on the turf
right,
essay.
I mean, the turf essay also, you know, in the course of writing, I decided to transition myself. So it that's probably part of sort of my fondness for that essay is also that sort of landmark role it ended up playing in my own life. So, you know, there's taking your philosophical commitments to the end point. There's a basilisk for you. And I suppose it would have been wrong to get out of that book with no weird, uncanny, and horrific revelations for myself. So, you know, that's very much the putting my money where my mouth is essay for me, I guess. But yeah, I end up I really like the bit at the end of that where I just sort of give the litany of trans engagements with monstrosity. That sort of just ends up being kind of the only one of the only hopeful moments in the book. I do something like it in the main essay where I sort of jokingly say, so if you wanted to, you could create a whole philosophical edifice based on the idea of empathy. Here are some things you might want to read to do that. Unfortunately, our premise is that we're fucked, so we can't do that. And I just sort of veer back into pessimism instead. And it's one of the funnier parts of the essay to me. But I kind of do it again in the TERF's essay, and just sort of throw this litany of ideas and concepts from the sort of ragged fringe of trans writing. That, you know, this isn't academic writing for the most part. This is Tumblr blogs. This is weird, very difficult queer art pieces published for, you know, niche audiences of 100. This is super marginal stuff in a lot of instances. But I sort of collect it and summarize bits of it and just sort of put it down as here's your hope, here's your way forward. It is for me the most optimistic essay in the book, and that's before you get into kind of its personal impact for me.
Right. I think that's a great way to sum it up.
But you wanted to talk about Peter Thiel, so let's do that.
Well, I did want to ask about it because I don't know. A lot of people don't know about how Thiel connects to these like neo-reactionary characters. How does he tie into like Moldbug and all these people? We talked about it a little.
Yeah, I mean, he funds Moldbug's company. Moldbug, you know, well, Yarvin's company. Since being a fascist blogger, Yarvin has started a very, very weird software project called Urbit that has no practical applications that anyone can tell, but it's very weird and novel. Thiel bankrupts it. Thiel is why this pointless project with no applications can, you know, have developers and continue. Thiel has read Moldbug, certainly. He's very personally influenced by Moldbug in his politics. And then Thiel also bankrolls Yudkowsky to a significant extent. He's not Yudkowsky's only source of funding by any means, and probably Urbit has gotten some other useful idiots as well. But Thiel bankrolls both of those, and there's plenty of other sort of odd projects that Thiel has put money behind over the years. His investment strategy is very consciously looking for sort of crackpots and oddballs.
Right. And he has that company, what is Palantir, which is like named after Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah, it's a data analytics company that was clearly in bed with Cambridge Analytica to a significant extent. It's not exactly clear how much, like, details of this keep not quite leaking out, but it sounds like that massive Facebook data set that Cambridge Analytica illegally harvested, they just sort of gave Palantir a copy of for frenzies.
Right, right. And how would go ahead.
So yeah, Thiel, yeah, so he's got, you know, Palantir, which is this vast data analytics company. He made his money initially off of PayPal, and then Palantir is sort of a metastasizing of PayPal's fraud detection AI.
How would you sum up Peter Thiel's like worldview? It's kind of dark.
Yeah, I mean, it's very near reactionary. He is all right. I am dead certain that Peter Thiel believes in, you know, scientific racism and the links between race and IQ. Certainly he thinks, certainly he supports Moldbug's sort of ideas of dictatorship and monarchy. He contributed $1 million to a Trump PAC at one point. Like, he's on the alt-right, period.
Well, he said infamously that he thinks democracy and freedom are no longer compatible.
Right, which is very clearly Moldbug. Like, that's clearly Moldbug's influence. That's a restatement of Moldbug.
Right, right. And I think it's kind of interesting now because, you know, you have this whole the Dark Enlightenment thing, and now there's this new online movement that people are calling the intellectual dark web, and I call it the intellectual dork web. But you know, Eric Weinstein and the Weinstein brothers who are part of this, Eric actually works for Thiel's company. Isn't that a surprise?
Yeah. No, I mean, Thiel is just one of those figures that crops up when you dig at anything on the alt-right. Like, scratch the surface and start setting up your sort of red string conspiracy board from any starting point on the alt-right, and, you know, you'll get to Thiel.
Right, it's a rabbit hole.
Right, and I don't want to suggest that, you know, this means that Thiel is the sort of secret puppet master behind it all. It's more that Thiel has the money, and the people with the money inevitably show up on that sort of conspiracy board. But on the other hand, if you're going to pick a sort of single center for the alt-right and the threads of money, your options are basically Thiel or Robert Mercer, who's another tech billionaire who owned Cambridge Analytica. So very sort of similar to Thiel. They're both sort of tech billionaires who got into data analytics and who bankroll a ton of alt-right shit.
Right, right. They're these like super capitalists basically that really are for that Moldbuggian idea of, well, you're poor, so die.
Yes.
You know, it's really horrifying.
Yes. So yeah, I wasn't actually originally going to end with the essay on Peter Thiel. Originally, I was going to throw a short story in there. But then I remembered that I hate writing fiction, basically. And it was basically either I could torture myself for 6 months to get a mediocre short story at the end of this book, or I could write a quick essay on Peter Thiel that would work better as a conclusion. So out goes the short story and goes the Thiel essay. Because that seemed like a sort of good way of cycling back to the concerns after this Turf's essay and after another sort of sidestep essay on David Icke and lizard people conspiracy theories. That was another sort of let's look at these issues through another lens from another perspective that gets the sort of fascism aspect out of it and lets us look at some of the underlying intellectual pathologies. And I felt like I needed to sort of circle back to the alt-right at the end, so I thought a essay on Peter Thiel, since he could serve as a sort of nominal centerpiece for the alt-right, would wrap things up well.
I think it was a great way to end the book, and, you know, I wanted to say, I remember in one of the early podcasts you did for the book on the Pex Lives website.
Oh, right, yeah, the ones where I just had a bunch of my friends interview me about my own book.
Yeah, I forget who it was that said sort of thought of your book as, you know, Ligotian philosophy of horror type stuff done from a schlock B-movie perspective.
I think that was Sam Keeper, the blonde yeah. Storming the Ivory. Oh, she's great. I love Sam.
Yeah, I call it the Plan 9 of horror philosophy.
Yeah.
Because the neo-reaction movement's kind of weird and, you know, schlocky.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good line.
Well, I was going to ask you, actually, because you reminded me, what led you to do the essay on Ike?
Oh, is it Ike? I never know how to pronounce him. Let's see. I just really like the lizard people conspiracy theories. I've always had a weird soft spot for them. And, you know, again, I'm writing crackpots and madness and monsters are all sort of the, along with the alt-right, the sort of underlying concerns. And I just wanted to look at a sort of crackpot conspiratorial worldview that wasn't overtly fascist, although certainly he has links in that direction because he is pathologically anti-Semitic at this point. But I just thought that would be a good sort of another way to look at philosophical horror and conspiracies and crackpots. And just lizard people are funny. You know, lizard people are just a fun angle. I wanted to write about... I've always wanted to do a piece about lizard people conspiracy theories. It's probably actually the essay I'm least happy with in the book. It just didn't quite take fire as much as I wanted it to. Part of it was when I got into the source material and really started, you know, reading his stuff. It just was bad. And not interesting bad, just sort of, oh, you're mentally unwell, aren't you? Bad. But there's still just something charming. I think what I kind of find charming and fascinating about him is the fact that realizing that lizard people run the world is such a useless piece of information. He can't do anything with it. Like, here he is, you know, constantly in book after book trumpeting the secret that will change the world, and it doesn't. Somehow knowing that lizard people run the world doesn't help you. And I think that's tragic and funny.
I like that. Although I do have to say, I think there's sort of a dark side to David Icke, too. When you look at his bibliographies, he cites so many of these like really anti-Semitic type stuff,
which I don't think he gets to that out of like an actual motive. Yeah, the motivation for that is not hatred of Jewish people. It's that what he's doing is sort of creating this conspiracy theory that lumps all of the existing conspiracy theories together. And when you do that, you inevitably sort of hoover up a large amount of anti-Semitism because there are a lot of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories in the world. That doesn't make it better. You know, anti-Semitism doesn't become suddenly not bad anymore if it's not motivated by just sort of actual hate of individual people. But it is important, I think, to realize that the anti-Semitism in Icke isn't motivated. It's not a starting point. It's sort of a consequence of it.
Right, right.
But yeah, I mean, there's a dark side to it. He's not just sort of a charming and entertaining kook. But on the other hand, there is sort of something funny about what I really like is sort of in his later work, you can see his increasing frustration at just how much of his time he's had to waste nailing down this lizard stuff. Like you get the sense that he sort of resents how much he has to talk about lizards instead of what he actually wants to talk about. And I really like that. I really like that, you know, he just sort of, the thing he seems to hate most about the lizard people these days is just how much of his time they take up.
Right, right.
It's like, but I want to talk about, you know, weird holistic new age medicine, but no, I have to keep going back to the lizard people. It's sort of a much more wholesome version of that Gamergate complaint. You know, I just wanted to play video games, but now I have to save Western civilization. It's like, I just wanted to play with crystals, but now I have to, you know, defend the world from the alien lizard people.
Right, right.
It's sort of a beautiful tragedy.
As with a lot of the characters in the book.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's pathetic in a way that is at once distressing, horrifying, and slightly charming.
So this leads me to, like, probably, I think it's a note we can end on. You know, we have the rise of the alt-right now and, you know, conspiracy theory thought, especially from the right wing.
Sure.
Becoming more and more mainstream. How do you think, Elizabeth, we can get out of this mess? Because it's a real mess.
I mean, I don't think we, in the sense of, you know, two people who had nothing better to do with their Friday evening than podcast, can do much. I do sort of take a position of pessimism on the individual level, in part because I think overemphasis of the individual level and the heroic is part of the problem.
I agree. I'm not a big fan of Jordan Peterson either.
Now, there was a way we could have stretched out the podcast another half hour. Yeah, I mean, I think that I certainly don't think that the solution to Moldbug is to just embrace the classically liberal tradition harder. I think that Moldbug isn't wrong that individualist liberalism has deep problems. He's just wrong about which problems they are. And so I'm skeptical of the individual level. I'm skeptical of the idea of what we can do. I think we are, you know, helplessly enthralled to a runaway political system that we can't stop. We can't unelect Trump. We can't reverse Brexit. We can't undo these things. And even if we, you know, in November vote in a Democratic Congress that, impeaches Trump, jams his agenda up, makes it easier to remove him in 2020, we can't get rid of the fact that 40% of the country voted for him. What do you do with 40% of the country thinks Donald fucking Trump is a good idea? There's not a lot to do with that. I think what we can do is haunt the future. I think what we can do is make the world a weirder place as best we can and try to introduce new ideas that unsettle things, that derail future philosophical lines of thought, that don't let things settle down and remain easy. I don't think that's an accelerationist project. I think, you know, accelerating the current trends in the world kills us all. But I think that there is something to that accelerationist idea that we have to grapple with problems. We have to create problems. We have to throw up roadblocks, whether in the resistance, you know, in the sort of material resistance sense. And I do think material resistance is important. I do think, you know, marches and demonstrations and attempts to mobilize mass movements are important. I certainly don't want to, you know, denigrate or marginalize the importance of popular uprising. But again, we're talking about mass movement here. You know, we're not talking about individual heroism. Absent a mass movement, absent a sort of consensus of actually let's put all the billionaires' heads on spikes, I think what we can do is introduce ideas, try to make the world weirder, try to bring the outside in, try to break the consensus, try to break the sort of hold of inevitability, try to make something that didn't seem inevitable happen.
I really like that sentiment. I think that's the only way to deal with the Anthropocene, or perhaps it's the Capitalocene, the Capitalocene, you know.
If nothing else, I feel like Anthropocene is, rolls off the tongue better.
Yeah, obviously.
Like, I understand the argument for the Capitalocene, but man, Anthropocene just sounds better in your mouth.
Well, hey, Elizabeth Sandifer, thank you again for coming on Parallax Views to talk about your book and your reaction about
it. Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Elizabeth Sandifer. Going to close out this edition of the show with a cover of John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness title theme by Hexencraft. Check them out, folks.